Well, there's a good chance that you don't think about your family every day and what it does for you, but over the course of your lifetime, you have probably given it a good deal of thought and rethought, too. We're going to be looking at the family, the importance of the family, the traditional family, the value, if you will, of the family, and we'll do it in the hour to come of University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, and my guest is Harry Brighouse. He's a professor of philosophy and affiliate professor of educational policy at the UW-Madison. He's also the co-author of Family Values, The Ethics of Parent-Child Relationships, published in 2014 by Princeton University Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks.
When you write a book like this, which in some ways is very theoretical, who do you address it to?
So we really had two audiences in mind. One is other academics. We thought that the question of the family has not been, the question of what justifies the family in particular, has not been addressed enough in the philosophical theoretical literature. So we wanted to write a book that would be interesting to people who are thinking about that in a fairly technical way. But we really tried to write the book in such a way that anybody who is really willing to pay a lot of attention and follow the contours of a debate could read it. We try not to use much technical language. My co-author is a fairly punchy writer, so there are some sort of nice sentences there. I tend to think of my audience, whenever I'm trying to write a book, I think about my undergraduates at UW-Madison, and I think about the undergraduates who sit sort of in the second row and are pretty attentive. And I think I want to write something that they are going to enjoy reading, even if it's an academic book that I'm thinking of an academic audience for.
And so what result do you want for the people who read the book? Is it in any way a call to action or just a call for them to think about their own families? Or in that sense, what's the purpose?
So I think I want different things for the different audiences. So for philosophers, fellow philosophers, I want to persuade them that the view about what justifies the family that Adam and I develop is the correct one. But for other readers, the general reader, but anybody who thinks about policy, I want them as well, or even just practice in your own family, how you treat your own children or how you treat your own parents. We wanted to provide them with intellectual resources for thinking better about the moral questions that they face when they do that. And of course, we don't think that you're going to, you know, persuade people of every detail of your complex 240-page argument. But we do think we've got something to offer when people are thinking, well, should I be sending my kid to a private school? Or I want to take my kid to church with me. My kid is very resistant to that. Is that okay? Right? What parts of my cultural life should I be sharing with my kid? What parts of my emotional life should I be sharing with my kid? And for government, there is no chapter in there about policy. We found it too hard to write a chapter about policy. But for the government, I think what we wanted to, there is a payoff from the book, which is that governments traditionally, I think about moving money around. They think about, and moving money around is important. They think about policy in terms of who has what amount of wealth and resources and whatever. And one of the things we wanted the government to think about is the family is a really important part of pretty much everybody's life. Successful family life is part of a flourishing life. And part of what government policy should be aimed at doing is ensuring that everybody has reasonable opportunities to enjoy family life. And that matters a lot when you think about policy toward the poor, for example. Poverty is extremely stressful, creates great stresses and pressures on family life, makes it harder to have a successful family life. And so on the one hand, we have a fairly egalitarian sort of outlook. On the other hand, we have a fairly conservative, I think, in some ways, picture of what family life should look like. And we want people to be able to have that.
Let's get into that first then this whole concept of what government can do to enhance family life?
So I think government can do lots of things to enhance family life, and it does some of those things. The government does provide, in most wealthy countries, the government does some subsidizing of the costs of rearing children. It pays for K-12 education, typically. It could improve the quality of K-12 education for some children. It doesn't exactly make sure that everybody, all children, get equally good K-12 education. It's not... The government can have living wage policies that ensure that families can thrive without both parents having to work 60 hours a week.
Which seem to, at least for much of the country, have been the case 50, 75 years ago. It was a one-income family that was the norm.
That's right. So I think so. One of the things that's happened in the last 40 years is you've seen a decline in real wages, not a decline in family income, because more people are working more hours. But that has real costs for children. It has real costs for adults too, because it's less, they're under more stress. It's harder for them to enjoy the intimacy of family life. And it's not as though they can sort of go off. I mean, for most of us, we can't just sort of go off and live in the middle of nowhere and, you know, live off the land and have a lot of leisure but not a lot of wealth. That's not really practical for most people. And so people live in an environment where other people are making it more difficult often for them to raise their children well. You think about people who live in neighborhoods which are dangerous. You know, if you live in a dangerous neighborhood, even if you have a completely sort of, even if you devote your life to ensuring your family does well, you're still under a kind of stress.
Yes.
That you're not, if you're not living in a dangerous neighborhood.
And so what can the government do to alleviate that?
Well, I think money helps.
Yes, so redistributing it, as you say.
Redistributing money helps. I think that we have some... education helps. I think that making sure that people who live in poverty have better educational opportunities, not just when they're kids, but when they are becoming parents, higher quality prenatal and antenatal health care. I think that period, I haven't had any children. My wife has had them, but, you know, I have three children, and the period, even in a relatively affluent home, the period immediately after the birth of any child is a very stressful time. And having the support, one of our children was born in the UK, and having the support of the health services, nurses who came to our home, partly to help and partly, frankly, to nose around and see whether we were really a safe family.
Uh-huh, really?
And I appreciated that. That made a difference. It made it less stressful. Helping you to, first of all, helping you to know better what to do with a young child, but secondly, helping you, even if you already know what to do with it, to do it, you know, knowing what to do and actually being able to do it when you have lots of other stresses on you are not the same thing.
And that's the sort of thing that's actually routine in the United Kingdom?
Completely routine in most of Western Europe, yeah. No, any family that doesn't have reasonably high quality pre and postnatal health support doesn't want it in those countries.
There's a word that you use throughout the book, and I wonder where this is going to be provided, how it's going to be provided. What exactly do you mean when you use the word rights?
Okay, so we mean something quite technical when we use the word right. So somebody has a right to something when other people are under an obligation to provide it for them. So you have a right to vote. What does that mean? That means that other people have an obligation to contribute to a system in which you get to have a say in who governs you. Where do those obligations come from? Now, that is something that we believe, I certainly believe, that moral interests and moral obligations are sort of built into the fabric of the world. They're like numbers, if you like. You've never seen a number, but numbers exist. And moral values, there are, you know, there are moral truths, and obligations exist, even though you've never seen one.
Do you feel at all that in writing a book about the value of the family, that people would say, well, of course, it's perfectly obvious.
Yeah.
Family is important. I mean, not just people, but the whole much of the animal kingdom has evolved that way. Of course, the family is important.
Yeah, so we were definitely in danger of writing a book defending something that nobody attacks. Now, that's not exactly true, because there have been both theorists and political movements that have attacked the family. Alexandra Kollontai, Marx and Engels.
Well, sure, yes. The Soviets certainly did.
Yeah. But what surprised us reading the philosophical literature is, I think, because people think it's obvious that the family is valuable, they don't spend a lot of time thinking about why it's valuable. And our book is supposed to be about why the family is valuable. And we were moved to this by thinking about, if you want, two kinds of problems. One is families act in a way that confers advantage on children. So
supposed
children,
to, yes.
What kind of family you grow up in affects your chances in life. Now, there are some things that we think absolutely people should be able to do to advantage their children, right? I think everybody thinks, and we in the book use this as a persistent example, people should be able to read bedtime stories to their children. People should be allowed to, not just that people should be allowed to, it's actually something really important that people should be allowed to do. And we even think they should do it, or something, things like it. But nobody thinks that you should be able to bribe a judge to gain advantage for your child. So where's the dividing line? And the dividing line can't just be where the law is, because if the law said it was legal to bribe judges, we'd still think it was wrong to bribe judges. We'd want the law changed. How do you find out where that dividing line is? And the way we thought, find out where that dividing line is by asking, well, why is the family valuable? What kinds of activities do people need to be able to engage in order to enjoy the value of family life? And what kinds of activities do they not need to be able to engage in? The other problem is about shaping your children's values. I think pretty much everybody thinks that you should be allowed, and again, these are two examples that we use in our book. Pretty much everybody thinks you should be able to take your child to church with you, and pretty much everybody thinks you should be able to take your child to a cricket match with you. I know that's an English example.
If you can find one.
If you can find one, yes, yes. And there are some in Madison. But nobody or very few people think that you have absolute right to control completely what your child thinks about everything. And I think pretty much everybody thinks that if your child persistently shows that they're not interested in cricket, it would be wrong to ram it down their throat, to sort of really push and push and push.
Now, you do make, in the book, you're careful to define your terms, and you define child at various stages of life, which I think is important, because if you're talking about an 18-month-old, of course, you take it to the cricket match, whether it enjoys cricket or not, but 12, 14, different story.
Yeah, so I will just say, if at 18 months old you take it to the cricket match, but you won't enjoy the cricket very much. But that's right. So I think that the child is a developing person, and there are at different stages it's appropriate for parents to exert and have different amounts of control. And if you think about taking a child to church with you, I mean, so I think it may well be that you ought to be able to carry on doing that well into the child's teen years. But whereas when you're taking a five-year-old with you, you're sharing a kind of experience with them and introducing them to something that's really important to you, that's part of your deepest beliefs and your practices. When the child is 14, maybe it's fine to carry on making them come to church, but you should be expecting them to exert some sort of critical reflection. And you should not be expecting them to just sort of take what you are telling them as the gospel truth. It would be a disappointment to most parents if their children at 14 are completely uncritical of the values that those parents are themselves espousing and trying to communicate.
It's certainly true in cultures that you and I would be familiar with, though not necessarily in all, especially if you're talking about female children.
Well, that's right. And so that's a way in which our theory about what makes the family valuable is a critical theory. So it's not the case that all families abide by the right values. There's a real problem in the culture and the practices of a family in which female children are expected into their teens to be completely obedient and to just sort of maintain the values that the family, the particular cultural or religious or moral values that the family is promoting. Something is going wrong in those families. And in cultures which promote that, something is going wrong. And just to be clear, you know, that's Anglo-Saxon culture until
right.
50, 60 years ago. So it's not, you know, I'm not criticizing other cultures. Think about the Victorians or the sort of the Victorian English
who thought their
children should be seen but not heard, and something terribly wrong was going on in those families. The adults are not getting the kind of valuable intimacy. Facing the challenge of preparing their child for adulthood. They tended to outsource that to
nannies. Well, I was going to say, that's right. So often the case in Victorian England or even in the upper strata in this country that it was outsourced. I'm reminded of the critic John Ruskin, Victorian critic, who in a very articulate way described all kinds of literary things, and included in that his early childhood, and summarized it by saying, "I had no one to love."
That's right. So that's a perfect example of a way that a certain kind of cultural practice deprives somebody of something that's enormously valuable, both in the moment, because a childhood is only a complete childhood when there's a lot of love in it. And of course, for their long-term development, you know, you screw people up by not loving them and by not giving them somebody to love over the course of their young childhood.
We're going to look at the rights, if you want to call them that, that parents have and that children have, and what children actually get out of the family when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Harry Brighouse. He is the co-author of Family Values, The Ethics of Parent-Child Relationships, and we're looking at the advantages of being part of a family. Well, for a child, one advantage of being at least having parents is, of course, you get to exist in the first place. But after that, things get much more complicated
yeah,
in terms of what a child derives from the family, from the parents in particular.
Yeah, so we think, I think you can divide the children's interests into five categories. So the child has an interest in developing cognitively. That's very important in our society. It's, you know, maybe less important in other societies in the past. They have obviously an interest in developing physically. And physical development doesn't just happen. You know, you have to be yes. fed and you have to be sheltered and whatever. They've an interest in developing emotionally, becoming, you know, you look at a baby, it's not very emotionally complex or interesting. They have an interest in developing to become somebody who can love, but who can also understand anger, can experience anger and identify it, and be angry appropriately, love appropriately, be discerning, emotionally complex. And, of course, they have an interest in developing morally, becoming decent people. And the fifth interest they have is not developmental at all. So I think the fifth interest is they have an interest in enjoying being a child. There are just great things in childhood that really you can't get later on. I always think about, you know, having had an English childhood, I didn't really get this, but I've seen, you know, my children enjoy these periods of being carefree. Sure. My youngest, he has this sort of joie de vivre that I don't know where he gets it from. And he won't have that when he's 40, and it might be good that he doesn't have it when he's 40, but when you're a child, you can have that, and it's wonderful to have it.
Maybe a freer rein for your imagination, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So a whole lot of sort of things that become much harder to experience in adulthood and maybe not possible to experience at all. And the job of the parent, the job of the family, is to oversee those interests of the child, make sure that the child emotionally, cognitively, physically, and morally develops healthily, and at the same time gets to enjoy the experience of just being in that stage of life. That's what children get out of the family. And we think that having a parent, that is, having somebody who loves you, who you can love, who is highly attentive to your needs, and who has a kind of continuity of care over a long period of time, is the only reliable way of getting those needs met. You have to have a parent. It's not that you couldn't possibly have those needs met by some other sort of in some other way. But for most people, it's not going to happen unless they have a parent.
I suppose there might be another thing, too, although it's kind of a thread that runs through much of what you've said, Harry, and that is that your parents carry your history for you.
They do. They carry your history in an interesting way, though. So one of the things that we don't think is that you need to have a biological parent to do this. Adoptive families, you know, everybody knows adoptive families that look a lot healthier than a lot of non, you know, biological families. But your connection with history, whether the parent is biological or not, your connection with the history before you were born is carried yes. by these people with whom you have this very intensive relationship. But of course, also, your connection with your own history. Nobody remembers anything before they were two.
Right.
And it's important for them to hear about what happened before they were two.
Who am I? Where did I come from?
Yeah. Who am I? How does what I'm doing now relate to what I'm doing now and who I am now relate to who I was then? And I have a very good and vivid memory, but lots of people don't. They've sort of these hazy memories and they sort of... it helps to have parents to tell you, yeah, when you were 14 or when you were 12 or when you were 6, you did this or that or the other. Oh, that sort of makes sense.
Yes.
So you carry both the prehistory and the history of the person as a parent.
And so children, you say, you know, have the right to all of these things. And that enables them, of course, to develop into adults, and I suppose at the same time, children, by dint of having consistent parents, again, whether they're biological or adoptive parents, you have that role model.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just for yourself as an individual, but also later, presumably, when you become a parent.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how would mom and dad have handled this?
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's very funny. My little boy, I've a 8-year-old who I just was chatting to a neighbor 2 days ago, and my boy was watching me, and afterwards he said, I like watching you dealing with other adults.
Said, really?
What do you mean? He said, yeah. I like seeing how you are, and that's, you do indeed model yourself on your parents. Sometimes one of the things you're finding out with your parents is, I shouldn't model myself on that person.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
And so they give you models both of how to be and of how not to be. And one of the things that, one of the jobs of a parent is to help the child develop the critical capacities that enables them to discern which bits are bits they should be and which bits are bits they shouldn't be. And again, I think you need intimacy. I do think children need other role models too. And one of the jobs of a parent is to ensure that there are other adult role models in the child's life.
This could be grandparents.
And that could be grandparents, and it could be uncles and aunts, and it could be neighbors, and it could be friends of the parents, and of course it's teachers.
Yes.
And of course, it can be the sibling, the friends of the child's siblings. I've got a big gap between my eldest and youngest, and I know that the youngest looks at the friends of the eldest and thinks of them as, especially the boys, as sort of, oh, you know, maybe I'd be like him, you know. So you provide all of that, and the child has to be able to trust that you're doing it reasonably well. And it's easy for the child to trust that if they have continuity, if they have one person or two people who are caring for them over the long span of their childhood.
Is what you're saying, Harry, about parents, we've been using the term parents, is that any kind of a commentary on single parents?
So The theory that we've developed is consistent with single parent being a family. I mean, obviously, it has to have a child in order to be consistent with two parent families, consistent with same sex parent families. I think it might even be consistent with three parent families. What I don't think it's consistent with is seven or eight parent families. I mean, I think that there's a point at which the child is not going to be able to make the, not only would it be inefficient, but the child is just not going to be, it's going to be too confusing, and they're not going to be able to make the right
kind of that kind of intimate connection that you
That's
need.
Right. There's a limited number of people that you can have that kind of intimacy with, and I think it's quite a small number. You know, the evidence about single-parent families is that, on average, children who grow up in with single parents are at risk of more bad outcomes. You know, they're at greater risk of lots of bad outcomes. Not hugely greater risk, but significantly greater risk. And, of course, it's hard to discern the causation. It could be that in that particular case, they'd be even worse off with the, you know, if they were
if they had
the
both
other
parents,
parent,
the yeah, other yeah, one yeah. being a bad one.
Yeah. But on average, you know, if you're a child, your preference would be to have two good parents rather than one good parent. But why? Just because, A, it's more resources coming your way. I mean, more emotional resources, more support.
And just more time.
Yeah, more time. They're going to be under less stress. Two good parents who are able to work together well are able to take the stress off one another. But also, somebody used the phrase, an economist used this phrase, but I really like it. It diversifies your care portfolio, right? I mean, it's just uh-huh. You know, suppose one of them dies. Well, then you still got the other one. Or
yes.
Suppose one of them is, you know, is incapacitated for some reason, then you've got the other one. It also diversifies your role model portfolio.
Sure.
And of course, what single parents can do, and they do, is they try to replicate that
yes.
with other kinds of relationships with adults, with other adults. So, you know,
some of which are unfortunate. I mean, you read often sure. about, you know, boyfriend
sure.
has committed some kind of crime in this family.
So boyfriend or, you know, step might be a bad deal, might be a good deal. Very often single mothers have relationships with their own mothers that bring in their own mothers who are the child's grandparents
yes.
as if another parent really, I mean, effectively have a parental relationship. And so what they do is they deploy their relationships with other adults to diversify the child's care portfolio and role model portfolio in a way that helps the child out.
And is there any sense, any statistics at all, do you know, Harry, having to do with the marital stability of a child from a one-parent family who presumably wouldn't have as role models the male-female relationship that the parents would provide?
Yeah, so I can't quote statistics to you. I do know that the findings in the U.S., and they're pretty well replicated in other wealthy countries, are that children whose parents separate, children whose parents divorce, and children who only grow up with one parent right from the start are at higher risk of such things as teen pregnancy, being involved in the criminal justice system, not graduating high school, than kids who are living with their both parents all the way through to age 18. But that is a minority of children. So it is now the case that a majority of 18-year-olds have not lived their entire childhood with both their original parents.
A majority now.
In the U.S., mm-hmm. yeah. A bare majority, but a majority.
And a growing majority?
I think it's stopped growing as fast as it grew in the, you know, when divorce and separation became more common. So I don't think it's growing particularly fast now, no.
Well, it's relatively easy to see some of the advantage, at least some of the advantages that a child would get from parents and from a stable family situation. But what do the parents get out of it? And what right does a parent have?
So, you know, if you want to be cynical, they're very expensive, children are. You know, you get a lot of interrupted nights of sleep. But people carry on having them. The way we think about it is we think, of course, different adults will give you different reasons why they had children. And some of those reasons look like pretty bad reasons. So people, you know, people fulfill their own dreams through their children.
Or try.
That looks kind of narcissistic to me.
Sure.
There's a kind of role that you play in somebody else's life that is very challenging. And meeting that challenge is extremely rewarding in the context of an intimate relationship characterized by sort of spontaneous love and intimate love. And it is the challenge of looking after those children's developmental and non-developmental interests in a world which is not necessarily cooperating particularly well with you. It's not like it's made easy. So you're raising the child, you're helping them to become fully competent, healthy, emotionally and healthy, cognitively developed adults, moral people, who are capable of being independent of you. So it's not like looking after a pet, right?
Which
will always be dependent. They're not like, you know, they're not like sort of human dogs. They are, the challenge is to develop them and then set them free into the world in which they can not just survive, but thrive and make a real contribution themselves, which may be quite different from the contribution you would have made. And that sort of last part is a really important part of what makes parenting challenging. But the whole thing is what makes parenting so valuable. So valuable that we think adults have, for many adults, not all, for some adults, their lives will be better if they never see a child at all, right? Or certainly
so
they never raise one. But for many adults, their lives will be significantly diminished if they don't have that experience over the course of a substantial part of their life of doing that.
So there's obviously fulfillment.
Yeah, and a deep kind of fulfillment that I would even... I hesitate to use the word need, and I can't remember whether we use the word need in the book. I think we probably don't. But for adults for whom it's a need, it's a need. It isn't a need for everybody, but for some it really is. It's something that their life will be much diminished without.
Well, we're in a slightly different world now than we were 75 or 100 years ago because being a parent is optional.
That's right, yeah. It is optional. Of course, there are some people for whom it's not.
Well, there are some people, they can't be parents,
yeah,
right.
They can't be parents, or at least they can't be biological parents. And one of the things that I think we want to, if you take the kind of view that we have, there are very important reasons to try and enable people who will be competent parents and for whom it's a need to adopt or to be able to reproduce in other ways, give them support and help. If you don't want to have children, you can avoid having children, by and large. People don't always make the right choices for themselves. So some people will, and you know, that in a free society, people are going to make choices that don't work out for them. And I suspect that some people regret not having had children for the kinds of reasons I've given. I also suspect some people, nobody ever admits to it, but I suspect some people regret having them because, in fact, it turned out that it wasn't something that was as valuable in their life as we think it is for many.
Of course, the thing with having children is you never know what you're going to get.
That's certainly true.
We'll look at other aspects of the family and when the state should intervene in this relationship between parent and children when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Harry Brighouse. He's the co-author of Family Values, The Ethics of Parent-Child Relationships, and he is also a professor of philosophy and an affiliate professor of educational policy at the UW-Madison. And we're looking at the dynamics of the family and the importance of the family, which at times may seem obvious, but there are a lot of things that may have gotten lost in the big picture. There are a couple of things I wanted to get back to, Harry. One was we were talking about adoption a little bit. Is there a point beyond which a child is feasibly adoptable?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. So I think you'd have to talk to psychologists who would be more and social workers who'd be more expert. The kind of relationship that we're talking about is only going to be fully enjoyed if you start with a child who's fairly young. That said, a child who is 14 or 12 and doesn't have a parent really needs a parent. And so I think that what happens, you know, if you're choosing between adopting a 12-year-old and a six-month-old, and you know that the six-month-old will get somebody perfectly good to adopt them, you're really choosing between yourself and the child. And, you know, if you want to get everything we describe in the book, you'll go for the six-month-old. If you want to ensure that, you know, if you want to maximize the chance of somebody's life being better, you'll go for the 12-year-old. You might not get as much out of it, but the 12-year-old, being 12 and not having a parent is really kind of a disaster.
Is there any way to know that this is going to work out? I mean, you know, we hear these stories about 12-year-olds who, you know, they've had such a terrible time,
yeah,
childhood in institutions or whatever, at no fault of their own, but have either they're rebellious or they have behaviors that are just impossible for these adoptive, yeah, parents to live with.
I'm amazed by adults who are able to, who have the patience and the ability and the emotional sort of richness and warmth to deal well with children who are already damaged. And, you know, there are lots of people like that in our community. And I don't know whether I don't believe I have that kind of capacity to do well by a kid like that. But it's tremendously urgent. That's a person, and that's their whole prospects in life. And the adult who says, okay, we're going to do this, they're doing something for all of us. And as a society, we need to give, first of all, I mean, obviously we need to honor those people who do those things, but secondly, we need to give them lots of material support. And I don't just mean money, although there's money too, but ensuring that they have ways of, you know, it's going to be very stressful and demanding, and we want to ensure that people can have breaks, that their children, you know, and this is not typically the case, but their child will, a 12-year-old in that situation needs to be, we need to ensure that they're in schools where they're really cared for well. And where they get the kinds of resources they need on top of whatever the adoptive parent is giving them.
This is another place you think maybe the state could play a role?
Yeah, I think the state has to play a role there.
Well, speaking of the state, is there a point in the inner workings of the family where the state should intervene, and what is that point?
Yeah. Look, states do not have a great record of intervening in interpersonal relations effectively for the good of the people in those interpersonal relations. And I think we have lots of reasons to be very cautious about recommending state intervention. That said, you know, of course, in every wealthy country where there are successful states, when children are sufficiently badly abused and neglected, states do take them away from their parents. And in some countries, before they do that, they give support to the parents. The state should not get out of that business. The state should be doing that. But we should be putting lots of research and resources into ensuring that the people who act on behalf of the state are well trained. You know, we want talented people managing them, and we want research about how to do it well. I think the state could do a lot more than it does in supporting families as opposed to intervening in them. Making sure, for example, so, you know, nobody thinks, oh, I know, it's a good strategy. I want my child to do well. I'm going to be poor, right? Yeah. Nobody thinks, oh, well, that's a great strategy. And absolutely nobody thinks, well, I'm poor. I know what would be a great strategy would be to go and live in a really deprived, disadvantaged neighborhood, right? People end up in those neighborhoods because we have constructed those neighborhoods. And we shouldn't. We should ensure that housing is mixed income. All housing should be mixed income. Everybody should be living in mixed income neighbors. Now, that's really hard to do, and I'm not criticizing politicians who haven't been able to figure out how to do it. But trying to figure out how to do that, ensuring high-quality health care, including, very importantly, high-quality mental health care, especially for families who have limited financial resources, and therefore are under all the kinds of stresses that having limited financial resources put you under. That's something the government could do, and it's something the government doesn't do very, you know, our government doesn't do very well. I come from another English-speaking country where the government doesn't do it particularly well either. But there are other countries where it is done better.
I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier, and that had to do with providing education, for example, as a benefit for the child. And as we get into, let's say, the middle school, high school, and certainly by the time college, you kind of implied that it wasn't necessarily the best moral course to provide a child with the most expensive or best education possible.
Yeah. So I think people can indulge themselves a bit here. So you have a child, but there are lots of other children, and those other children matter too. And in a highly competitive society like ours, where rewards are spread very unequally, you know, if you're at the top of the income distribution, you have a lot of income. If you're halfway down or below, you've a lot less, and a lot less security, and a lot less of all the other things that people care about in life. And you yourself know that your child, you know, has a pretty good chance of doing pretty well. I think my children have a pretty good chance of doing pretty well. Ramping things up so that you try to get their maximal advantage is something you should be very cautious about doing. And it's certainly not something that you need to do in order to have a successful family life and good intimate relationships with your children. It's not something they need. And it can harm others. And so in the classic case, so this is not in the US, but in the UK, the way that the top 5% harm the children of other families, is by taking their children out of public schools, putting them in private schools where they spend an enormous amount of money on them, and then voting in ways that ensure that those public schools don't get the kind of resources that would enable the kids in them to compete well with their top 5% kids.
I'm guessing also a phenomenon in parts of this country.
Well, and it's a phenomenon, the way it plays out in the US is by people moving to very wealthy suburbs. So you think about the suburbs around Milwaukee. You think about suburbs in which the child poverty rate is 2%, 3%. More money is spent per kid in those schools than in Milwaukee public schools. The kids who are in the Milwaukee public schools can't get out and be in those high-spending schools. And they're competing for the same teacher labor pool, so they're able to hire more experienced, better qualified, probably on average better teachers for their kids than the Milwaukee public school schools are. And you have then a kind of... your kids, if you're bringing them up in Brookfield or Wauwatosa, have a huge competitive advantage over those other kids. And you're not voting. And now, of course, if you're voting for and lobbying for ensuring that the state is putting lots more money in Milwaukee public schools than it does into Brookfield or Wauwatosa, that makes it a bit different. But still, do your kids need that level of advantage? Understanding that in our society, not in all societies, and we could organize things differently, but in our society, it is a very competitive society, and one person's success is often at the cost of other people.
Sure. That's sort of the nature of the animal kingdom, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
well, if we pull back and look at the future of the family, now, I think you've been espousing, Harry, a traditional look at the family, which is to say there are real advantages for everybody involved in a family where there are two parents, manageable number of children, perhaps even an extended family, to give you some kind of perspective and a sense of role models. But where are we going with it?
Yeah, I think that's a hard question. So I'm a philosopher, not a social scientist or a futurist. I think there are trends that we've seen there are some trends we've seen that are, that I think are good, and there are some others that are bad. And I suspect they'll both continue to some extent. So let's go for a simple and maybe slightly off, you know, off the radar bad trend, which I think is the breakup of extended families. So people live further from their when they grow up, they live further from their parents than they used to. Not in times of mass migration, but whereas 60 years ago, the chances were that when you had a kid, you had a parent who was around who might be able to help you and with whom that kid would have a relationship. The chances are much less high now that that's the case. People around who care about you and who care about you raising the kid well. And that has to do partly with the introduction of highways. It has partly to do with economic growth, you know, which I'm not that keen on highways, but economic growth is a good thing. I hope that that trend can reverse some. And, you know, I suppose the improvement in communications, the fact that kids can Skype with their grandparents even if they live 2,000 miles away.
Not maybe as good maybe as actually face-to-face, but something?
Something. I mean, obviously not as good as playing rummy with them or just goofing around with them or being told, you know, as my father, you know, my father encourages my children to be extremely rude, you know. I mean, that sort of, that's a real loss, you know. I think that, I think there is some stabilization around around two-parent families, and I think that's and I think much more tolerance and support for single-parent families that makes on the one hand makes single-parent families probably more likely to occur. On the other hand, makes it a less isolating and and horrifying, you know, difficult experience. So those seem, you know, those, there's some positives and some negatives there. I don't see the family, I don't see parenting going away, right? I hope that in 30 years' time, and I think this is another thing that is unhealthy. You might think if you read our book, oh, you know, well, you know, parents should just be in their children's faces all the time. No, we actually don't think that. Like, I think there's something very unhealthy going on in upper middle class families. The helicopter parenting, the kind of insistent sort of weird controlling of the daily life of the kid.
There's a lot of scheduling, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of scheduling. And I hope that goes away some. I hope that children get to... I hope, and I'm not very hopeful about it, but I do hope that we can move to a world in which children are less scheduled, less heavily monitored, more able to just be children and live out childhood and the enjoyment and carefreeness and whatever that we sort of have in our minds about what a childhood should be like. Maybe less obsessive about... making sure that they can read before they go to kindergarten and making sure that, you know, that constant. I also hope that children, I hope we can raise the age at which children get hold of electronic devices.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I, like I said, I'm a philosopher, not a futurist.
Well, Harry Brighouse, thank you for joining me for University of the Air.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can be tuned in next time for University of the Air.